So the theme of this talk is the preciousness of this body, as it's described in the first reminder. And really, that's the preciousness of a human birth, the preciousness of a human birth. And my title for the talk is This Very Precious Opportunity. This Very Precious Opportunity. So I begin by reading the first of the four reminders. Previously, I have circled in samsaric existence like a water wheel, most often wandering in places of no leisure without meeting this excellent path. In this life, I have obtained a foundation of leisure and endowments. Am cared for by an excellent spiritual guide and have met the supreme path. To remain at ease now is extremely foolish. So I just want to say a little bit about that passage. So it begins previously. So this could be past lives or it can be our life before we met the Dharma. And it begins with this description of samsara, which is like a water wheel. A water wheel would have been a very familiar image to the Tibetans, just of a kind of relentless turning round and turning round and turning round. And that is caught in the language here, because you have the word circled, and then a little later the word wandering. So there's a sense of things being repetitive, aimless, monotonous. And we could think about what might be our modern equivalents, our modern images for that. So it could be like being on a tube train, endlessly going round the circle line. It could be like being in a factory, working on a conveyor belt. No rest, no change, no variety. And our past may have been like that, and our future could well be like that. But now, in this life here and now, there is leisure and endowments. So leisure, space, freedom, lack of pressure, and endowments, which are often called blessings. So I think it's good to see blessings as being also opportunities. Otherwise, they're limited. So blessings are opportunities. They're opportunities for spiritual growth and change. Ultimately for opening up to the transcendental, to wisdom and compassion. And then as we move on within this passage, we move into superlatives, this excellent path. And there's a first person immediacy, it's about each of us. So I am cared for by an excellent spiritual guide. I have met the supreme path. And the conclusion, to remain at ease now is extremely foolish. So this passage I think is dramatic, it's urgent, and it's setting the scene for the later reminders. And it opens us up to some important teachings. So starting in the Pali Canon, you may be familiar with the Buddha's description of the old blind turtle. Yeah, so I'll read about him. An old blind turtle lives for thousands of years at the bottom of the seven oceans. Once every 100 years, it surfaces for breath. There is also a golden yolk floating on the surface of the vast ocean, never staying in one place for more than a second. And then the question is, can it put its head through the yolk? So this is against incredibly, incredibly, incredibly huge odds, seemingly impossible odds. And Bhante has said that if the turtle was able to surface for breath, this would be the equivalent of being born in the human realm. If it's able to put its head through the yolk, this is the equivalent of having the opportunity to go for refuge. And actually, for us, this has happened. Unbelievably, amazingly, against all odds, we have been born into the human realm and we have the opportunity to go for refuge. And now turning to another teaching, this is moving on to the Tibetan tradition. So Gampopa in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Tibetan tradition, of course, is also the tradition of the Four Reminders. And this is very primary teaching, actually, around this area. And Bante also did a very, very good seminar on it. So I'm going to draw quite a lot on Gampopa's definitions here. So he writes about the freedoms and the endowments. And there are 8 freedoms and 10 endowments or blessings. And later on I will put up his formal list on the notice board. Some of these are objective. Some of these are personal and subjective. And when they all coincide, then it's described as the unique occasion or the right juncture. And elsewhere it's described as the precious opportunity if everything actually manages to come together. So this is conditionality, and if all the right conditions are in place and come together and meet. And when they do, essentially it means that we can attain insight, we can become enlightened. And Gampopa also said that just to be human, being in the human realm, is like a vase containing the elixir of immortality. So there's wonder there, there's vision there about what it means for each of us to be human. We are each like a vase containing the elixir of immortality. So I'm going to carry on summarising the freedoms and the endowments, and I've sort of reorganised these a bit for our purposes. So the freedoms are mainly being free from birth in the other realms. So this is the Tibetan tradition, it's the imagery of the wheel of life. So it means that we're not hungry ghosts, animals, asuras, we're not living in the hell realm, and we're not living in the god realm, in that traditional perspective. And those states, you probably know, can also just symbolise all-absorbing mental states, states without any kind of variety of experience, which are very difficult to move on from. So it could be all-absorbing psychological states, obsession, compulsion, neurosis, and we're not in those states either. Nor are we in a god realm. A god realm is, well, in one sense it's deeply enjoyable when you're blissed out, but it's too comfortable, too at ease, why bother to change? But also it is impermanent. So in that state we will run out of merit. So we need to feel the unsatisfactoriness even within the comfort. We need to feel the edge, the spur to practice. So, moving on from the endowments to the blessings. Firstly, we are born a human being. We are here in the human realm. And also, we are born in a relatively stable country. So, this is a place where we are allowed to practice. So, some of these objective conditions have come into place. And then, we have a mind capable of understanding the teaching. And we have a mind free from extreme wrong views, so not closed down, not fixed, not totally unresponsive. We have an open mind. And all of this is the spiritual potential of human consciousness. And so the subjective conditions are also coming into place. And this means that we can have a varied, creative response to experience, not a fixed one. And Gampopa writes about our experience as the slight misery of human existence. So again, this is the edge, this is the unsatisfactoriness. But it's not so awful that we can't practice, and it's not so blissful that we don't practice. We feel pleasure and pain, we suffer, but it's not overwhelming and utterly incapacitating. And this means that we can also have ethical awareness, choice, we can be creative, we can work with our own samskaras, we can work with karmic conditionality, we can grow and change, we can experience shame, we can confess, we can accumulate merit, we can act for the good. And Bhante in the seminar on the Dual Ornament of Liberation said that it means that we can develop qualities such as self-awareness, emotional positivity, responsibility, fidelity, cooperativeness. So all those positive, actually human ways of being. So moving on to our very main blessings. A Buddha has appeared in the world. The Dharma has been taught. You have come in contact with the Dharma and have found a teacher. And you are capable of feeling compassion and love for the sake of others as well as for yourself. And I will put these up on the notice board. So these are key blessings. I'll read them again. A Buddha has appeared in the world. The Dharma has been taught. You have come in contact with the Dharma and have found a teacher. And you are capable of feeling compassion and love for the sake of others as well as for yourself. So those are very profound blessings. And Kampopa says that when these come together, then faith can arise, which is like our individual momentum beginning to take off. So that's that deep inner response. And this is, and faith he describes as a deep conviction in the truth of the three jewels, a lucid, serene dwelling with that truth, and a longing for what now becomes possible. So what's happening is dynamic, transformative. We're stepping out onto the path. We have the freedoms and the blessings. So we can fully develop our human potential, which is our spiritual potential, and we can live lives which are truly meaningful. And Bhante also says that with the blessings and the freedoms, we're 2/3 of the way to stream entry, but the last third is the hardest. And all of this has enabled us to be here now, sitting in the Taraloka Lounge on a sunlit Sunday morning in February. And we're all followers of the Buddha, and we're all mitras, at least. So I'll say a little bit about the conditions that drew me to the three jewels. So one of the main meanings of my name, Samanta Badri, is completely blessed. And when my preceptor, Sangadevi, gave me that name, she said it's because in my letters to her before ordination, I had often described myself as blessed. And I hadn't actually noticed this myself, but when I received the name, I felt an resonance with it. So I'll go on to say a little bit more about my story, but we all have our stories around this. They're very different, but we all have our stories about how we first met the Dharma. And there's a kind of collective resonance between us in that way. So I grew up in spiritually positive conditions. So I grew up in a civilized, stable country with religious freedom. And I grew up in a stable family. Not much money, but education, culture, nature. And I think in my own being, I always had a sense that I was seeking meaning, always had a sense that I was on a quest. And then later, as often happens, I moved into a period which was much more of suffering and self-doubt about who I was. I'd had a particular failed relationship, and it wasn't actually the particular loss of the relationship which was affecting me so deeply, but just a sense of not knowing what my future would be and not knowing how it could be fulfilling. So there was loss there, but also there was possibility there as well. But at the time, it felt like an individual lonely life. and some quite dark days. Always remember, when you live on your own for the first time, you start shopping for yourself. And suddenly you're buying much smaller quantities. And I just have these memories of going on a Saturday morning to the local shop and buying this little bag of sprouts. And I knew exactly how many I would eat over the days. You know, and then that was a sort of manifestation of loneliness and a self-orientated life in a way as well. And I remember even more one of those envelopes coming through the door, which said on the outside, "You have just won a wonderful prize." And I just thought, no, I haven't. But potentially, I was a vase containing the elixir of immortality. So 5 years later, after I'd moved to Colchester, I heard a talk on Woman's Hour one Sunday afternoon about women who meditated. And I was still seeking meaning, still on a bit of a quest. And I turned on the radio by chance. I was just cooking supper. And that changed my life. And it changed my life in a quite extraordinary way. And when I heard that particular conversation about women who meditated, I decided that I would learn to meditate. I heard that particular interview. So that, in a way, was the my blind turtle experience, a coincidence seemingly against the odds. And then, even more, my parents lived in Norfolk, and they lived next door to a house called Wilby Cottage in a village called Brundle. And this is the 1980s. In that village at that time, there happened to be, well, over those years, 6 order members, which was quite unusual for that time, and 2 successive couples lived next door to my parents. I visited my parents a lot, and unknown to me, you know, there was the Buddhist life, even the order life playing itself out next door. And they had quite a lot of visitors as well. At that time, there were only about 30 Dharmacharinis, and 3 were in that village. Yeah. And my mum was a good neighbour, so she got on well with the people she called the Buddhists. And when one of them went to be ordained, who became Padmavati, my mum was taking in the mail, and so she commented on the change of name. You know, so she was moving deeper into that world. And when I told my mother about the wish to meditate, having not been able to find anything in Colchester, she just said, "Oh, well, let's talk to Padmavati." So Padmavati had moved by then, came round. And my mother and I went to Norwich Buddhist Centre. And then a year later, I came to Taraloka. I came here, which was hugely significant. Gosh, it was much less comfortable. So this room was a barn. And yeah, I was deeply, deeply affected by that retreat, and particularly by the women leading it. And I'll say more about this a little bit later, but I felt that my world was changing from monochrome to technicolor. And I had what I think many of us have experienced, that sense of adventure and that sense of coming home. And I had just won a wonderful prize, and it might not have happened. So we all have our own personal blessings, our own personal stories. So what first brought you along? What drew you to the Dharma? What made you stay? Who helped you or inspired you? Your right juncture, your unique opportunity, your freedoms and your blessings. So, moving away from my personal story and returning to the blessings again, and particularly to the blessings of receiving the 3 jewels in our lives. And I want to refer quite a bit to the Tiratnavandana because it fits in so well with this, and we're chanting these verses each morning. So the Tiratnavandana is, of course, as Suchita has already said, salutation to the 3 jewels. And it's 3 parts of the Buddha Vandana, the Dharma Vandana, and the Sangha Vandana. So that primary blessing, the Buddha has appeared in our world. All those centuries ago, not lost. People then meeting the Buddha, happening then, and in a different way, it's still happening now. So the words of the Tiratnavandana capture the immediate response to the appearance of the Buddha. Such indeed is he, the richly endowed, the free, the fully and perfectly awake. And when someone met the Buddha, they were so excited. It was wonderful. Marvellous was the word that they often used. And there was often a standard response, which we could also share. So this is quoting Pakusa of the Mala clan from the Parinibbana Sutta. His account of his experience. What was overthrown has been set upright. What was hidden has been revealed. A lamp has been lit in the darkness. And that's what people, something like that, that's what people said again and again. And we could say that. Things in their right place, not upside down, not lost, not dark. We can be as we truly are. And of course, for many people, it doesn't happen. There's the missed opportunity, the blessing that doesn't occur. So that's when not all the conditions are in place. It's not quite the right juncture, and it might be missed by moments. So you may well remember this. The Buddha, enlightened, goes forth to teach the Dharma, and he has to ask himself, who shall I teach? So he thinks of his former teachers. So there's Alara Kalama, but he died 7 days ago. There's Udaka Ramaputta, but he died last night. He just missed it. And so a Buddha had not appeared in their world. So the Buddha sets off and he meets the monk Upaka. And the monk Upaka asks him a lot of questions about who he is. And the Buddha explains who he is. He says that he's the awakened one. And Upaka says, oh, well, that's interesting. And then, to quote, he took a side track and departed. So Upaka walked off on his own. And our life could also have been a side track. So I'm deeply moved to chant the words of the Tiratnavandana, the Buddha Vandana. Buddhaṃ jivita parayantaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. All my life I go for refuge to the awakened one. So moving on with the blessings, the Dharma. We have two blessings here. The Dharma has been taught, and then it is still and accessible and alive as a teaching. And our first reminder, of course, the Dharma is the supreme path, this excellent path. So the Dharma, the way things are, the nature of existence, the mundane, conditionality playing itself out in the furthest reaches of outer space and in the patch of grass outside the shrine room. And the Dharma also, the vision of the transcendental. The only thing that meets our faith, our longing, our aspiration. And the Buddha gives a description of his own discovery of the Dharma, or really a fable, I think, of his own discovery of the Dharma. So an images for it. So I'm being slightly incorrect here. I think it's the Buddha's discovery, but anybody's discovery of the Dharma. Suppose a man wandering in a forest wilderness found an ancient path, an ancient trail, travelled by men of old, and he followed it up, and by doing so he discovered an ancient city, an ancient royal capital, where men of old had lived, with parks and groves and lakes, walled round and beautiful to see. So I too found the ancient path, the ancient trail, travelled by the fully enlightened ones of old. And of course we too have found that ancient path, that ancient trail. And when people met the Buddha, So they were so close to the opportunity to hear the Dharma for the first time. The Buddha would say, come see, to all those individuals that he met. Merchants, mothers, beggars, bandits, and also to us. So in the words of the Dharma Vandana, ahipassiko, of the nature of a personal invitation to you, to me, come see, you come, you see. And I remember on that first retreat at Tara Lota, sitting by the canal, reading the Buddhist vision and just saying, ah, yes. And I'm deeply moved to chant, Dharmang Jivita Parayantang Saranangacchami, to say, all my life I go for refuge to the Dharma. So, next blessing. I have come into contact with the Dharma and have found a teacher. And in our reminder, I am cared for by an excellent spiritual guide. So this is the emphasis on care. So that is a teacher in the Tibetan tradition, but we can transfer that to Bante, different kind of teacher, but our teacher. Bante, who made sense of it all, who lived the Dharma life, and in some very tough conditions. I think last year I reread The Thousand Petaled Lotus, and I was really struck by the bit where Bante and his companion Satchapriya just couldn't wait to be ordained. So in the height of the Indian summer, at midday, they walked along the railway track day after day to get to Kusinara to be ordained, because they couldn't wait. So Bante, a complex, suffering, aspiring human being with a very fine mind, and he has given us the gift of the Dharma. All those books, all those talks, all those meetings with anyone, almost anyone who asks to see him, he set up the conditions and he guides us along the way. And he's still doing it. And it was like he's in his final days of vision. And in those last papers, which Subhuti has written from his conversations with Bante, it strikes me as being like the vision of an artist near the end of their life. It's like Beethoven's last string quartets. And of course, it's more than that. And Bante speaking from that space, which is closer to death, you know, when things are dissolving, and saying what our contemporary minds probably can't yet fully understand. And wonderful things like reimagining the Buddha, encouraging us to reimagine, which is a new term. And all this gives us the tools to take responsibility for our spiritual progress. And in particular, Bante saw the potential of Sangha, of spiritual friendship, in a quite revolutionary as well as traditional way. So that we have his emphasis on spiritual friendship in terms of vertical friendship and horizontal friendship, and his emphasis on collective practice. And this vision gave birth to the order, which is quite unique. And I think back to myself, actually, on my first Tara Loka retreat, and with limited experience of Sangha. I was living in Colchester and visiting Norwich Buddhist Centre. And on that first retreat, I kept myself quite isolated. And my joke about this has always been, I'm the only person to have a solitary retreat with 35 others. But the team there were women who are going to be hugely significant in my life, and I didn't know. So it was led by Sangha Devi, who's my private and public preceptor. The team included Dayanandi, who's my Kalyana Mitra, and also Sobhanar, who's been a very, very long-standing friend. And I would never have guessed that they would visit my house, become my friends, still are. And looking at this talk, I thought, well, actually, I've been in contact, or will be in contact, with each of these this month. But on that retreat, at that time, I would have had no idea of the potential of spiritual friendship for me. Our Tibetan texts, and the first reminder, don't mention Sangha so explicitly, but I still want to get to the lines in the Triratnavandana, So those lines honour Sangha in the transcendental sense, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and that includes those first enlightened bhikkhus and bhikkhunis who were once merchants, mothers, farmers, beggars. And Sangha Vandana has some beautiful words. He describes those beings as now worthy of worship, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of salutation with folded hands. So I'm moved again by the Sangha, an inexhaustible source of goodness to the world, Punya Ketan Lokasati, an inexhaustible source of goodness to the world. And we can chant Sanghang Jivita Pariantang Saranangachami. We can say, all my life I go for refuge to the Sangha. So for us, the three jewels are accessible and alive. But what if they were lost? And at some moment in the future, in this period of history, they probably will be. So imagine, maybe, this is no longer a relatively stable, civilized country. Maybe because of environmental chaos, terrorist violence, financial collapse, political oppression. The world is lost. The Dharma is lost. And maybe you just find a tiny scrap of a picture blowing in the dust and just make out a hand touching the earth. Is it the Buddha? And you hold it, knowing it too is disintegrating. Or just our minds begin to fade, old age. And there's a quotation in one's head, but what was it? Something, something was the whole of the spiritual life. But what was it? What was it? For me, I can imagine maybe meeting just one order member, a Dharmacharya among the ruins, who I might hardly have noticed in a queue at the convention. And now it means everything. So here now we have so much. And do we do enough? Will we do enough? And what might we regret in our last lucid moments before dying, when things are dissolving for us? And even I just think about all those towns and cities that don't have a Buddhist centre, the women that haven't heard the Dharma, haven't come along, the lost Mitras, the lost Dharmacharanis. You know, what if there was Blackpool Buddhist Centre, Belfast Buddhist Centre, York Buddhist Centre, Bradford Buddhist Centre? So all of these areas obviously raise much familiar teaching, which I won't go into in very much detail, but we will do in our later presentations this week and in our reflection. But they obviously connect also with our underlying existential ignorance, the pull of greed, hatred and delusion, which is relentless because they don't bring lasting satisfaction. So our tendency is we just keep on doing it. Keep on wanting, keep on disliking, keep on being confused, and the wheel spins even faster. And our contemporary world is civilized, it is stable, but it can also be insidious because it's prosperous. There's so much choice. And that gives us the expectation that we can have what we want, that we can fix samsara, we can make it okay for us. We polish the wheel, and the wheel spins faster. And in good times, there's also complacency. So I ask myself, what's the difference between complacency and contentment? And I think with complacency, we're out of touch with the truth, with impermanence. It's a bit of a God realm. There's no vision there. We're attached to positive conditions. Whereas in contentment, with contentment, it's about appreciation. We know that things will pass, but we can have that refined response and experience joy. And ironically, this is a richer experience. And for all of us, I think there's the dangers of a spiritual plateau. We can enjoy the benefits of a more spiritual life, better states of mind, friendship, interesting study, But where have we got the momentum? And this led me to think a bit about merit, because actually we probably have loads of merit, and it's brought us to the right juncture and the consequence of years of practice. We shine with it, people notice it, but merit is not a package that permeates our being. Well, the risk with merit is that we can just enjoy this and be at ease now. We can be in a God realm and live off it and use it up. Or we can let it be the condition for further progress, let it flow more deeply, creatively within us. And beyond this, of course, we can transfer our merit. We can give it away to alleviate the suffering of all beings. So, human mind consciousness can make a real mess of things, but also it's a blessing with unbounded potential. We have minds that can meditate, reflect, contemplate. We have minds that can imagine. We have minds that are ethically sensitive. We have minds that can be suffused with faith. We have minds that can gain insight. We have minds that can know the transcendental. And actually, there's still one last blessing to mention, which is really interesting. You are capable of feeling compassion and love for the sake of others as well as for yourself. So this is the mind as it truly is, beyond the boundaries of self, in living relationship, in connection with all beings just as they are, head and heart, seeing and feeling and responding, standing alongside, trembling with another's suffering, kindness, metta, gratitude, compassion, connection, collective practice for the benefit of all beings, and the Sangha as an inexhaustible source of goodness to the world. And when we feel these things, then we truly are a vase containing the elixir of immortality. So, drawing towards the conclusion, it was this mind with all its potential that brought you to your Mitra ceremony, where you held the delicate stem of the flower and offered it to the three jewels, where you saw the glowing light of the candle and offered it to the three jewels, where you breathed the sweet scent of incense and offered it to the three jewels. And the Sangha witnessed this and rejoiced. So here now, sitting in the Tara Loka Lounge on a sunlit Sunday morning in February, you have a mind that can deeply benefit from this retreat and can give to it. You have a mind that can make further spiritual progress. The possibilities are limitless. So finally, to remain at ease now is extremely foolish.